When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome, welcome everyone to Talking Tennis. It's our weekly WTA show, which will be running all the way up until Wimbledon, hopefully, most weeks. Absolute privilege to host, absolute privilege to be speaking with you and with our guest, Hanlon Walsh. Hanlon, how are you doing? Where are you coming to us from?
Hey, Nick, I'm doing well. Thank you. I am coming from Birmingham, Alabama, in the southeast part of the U.S., and I actually just got back from Charleston, South Carolina, from the Charleston Open late last night. So excited to talk all things WTA in Charleston.
Play.
Well, hello there. Welcome to WTA Weekly, Rene Stubbs. Lovely to have you back on again. Thank you for coming.
Good to be here.
Play.
Well, hello there. We are winding down from Wimbledon on WTA Weekly. And it's my great pleasure to have Pam Shriver join us to debrief on what I have to say was a wonderful women's singles tournament. Pam, how are you doing?
I'm good. It's like whether you play or whether you broadcast or whether you play the Legends event, whenever you go through 2 weeks of Wimbledon, or in my case, it'll be 3 weeks tomorrow since I left LA. My home, it's exhausting.
Play.
Hello, hello. Welcome to Talking Tennis and welcome to the WTA show. And it's WTA Weekly. And it's a momentous one because we're in the week before Roland Garros and everyone's very excited. As I assume our guest also is, this is Chimani Carroll, who is the tennis correspondent for The Guardian. How are you doing, Chimani?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me. I am very excited for...
Ready?
Well, hello there. Welcome to WTA Weekly, 1 year on. It's been a fun year, it has to be said. Great memories of seeing, well, me flundering about trying to work out what I was doing with all kinds of interesting people. But no more interesting than a man whose tennis opinions I have the utmost respect for, and that's Jack Edwards. Jack, how are you doing?
I actually didn't know that was going to be me there, Nick. Thank you very much. Genuinely didn't. Thank you very much. No, I'm good, thank you. Yeah, just lost a tennis match. Got that disappointing feeling. But, you know, I sometimes think when you lose a tennis match, you realise just how much you like it. Because I feel something, you know. I really feel a want to get back out there. I feel anger, Nick. I feel rage. I feel loads of different things. So it's good. I am good. I genuinely am good, even though I'm also raging at losing that much.
There's probably a number of tennis players. In fact, most tennis players who were playing last week feeling probably very similar.
Yeah.
Probably being Daria Kasatkina, who lost in the final at Charleston, or Marie Bushkova, who lost in the final at Bogota.
Yeah, I mean, all these players get used to losing every week, right? And I'm not quite there yet, unfortunately. So I can't quite call myself a professional yet if I can't take a loss on the chin super well, Nick. I'd say that much.
It's fine. You're a professional in many other respects, and hard to lose in those. We're definitely not losing out by having you on the show, WTA Weekly, and I'll do probably a bit more of a tribute later on the show to like how. The past year or so, but I do want to get stuck into the tennis and the tennis action because that's what we're doing here. And I guess the obvious thing to start with is Charleston and Danielle Collins is on a incredible winning streak right now. I have run out of superlatives for Danielle Collins. I commentated on her semi-final. I commentated on the final and it just got better and better and better. And I think those of you who maybe are regular viewers are probably fed up of me talking about Danielle Collins. So I'm going to let you do it, Jack. Do you have any superlatives?
I think I can go in for a pinch of salt because let's begrudgingly rewind a week. And I'm sure John's got the clip on save where I was like, we were talking about Collins and her potential and will the streak continue? And I was kind of like, yeah, you know, I don't know. It's like somebody just had a hot streak, whatever. Collins hits big for a week. Might not happen next week. You know, she might just be back to like losing every match. I'll eat my words because there's definitely 100% a consistency about the insane, fearless tennis that she's playing. Particularly on return, where it's just like, you know, as soon as she gets a chance on a second serve, oh my God, it's like, it's just brutal. It's so tough for some of these players who really don't have much of a second serve. And we saw that in the final in particular, Nick, with Daria Kasatkina's performance. Not much she could do, you know, it is what it is. She's not got a particularly good second serve. Collins ate it up like she did the rest of the week with the rest of the field. It's great stuff. It's really good to watch. And, you know, when you get a player like this who's playing this aggressively, just fearlessly, I think that's really the word, you know, just playing without, you know, any abandon, but not in quite the same way as an Ostapenko, for example, where it's just like, oh, I'll hit the back fence maybe this time. It's like Collins is just so confident. It's amazing. Like that's the word I would use, confidence. It's beautiful.
Yeah. She's timing everything perfectly. Like, well, maybe not everything's an exaggeration, but most of her shots were wonderfully executed. And yeah, you're right. Confidence is just where she's at. And I think, look, we've said a lot before, like she's swinging freely because she's got nothing left to lose anymore. Her career's coming to an end. So at the minute, she's just playing for like herself and only herself. And not trying to build a rank or anything else. And ironically, that's exactly what we're doing because now we're asking questions about whether she's going to make top 10 during clay season, which we'll come back to. But with, I guess, let's take this level of hyperbole a bit high because you're right. We had players like Kasatkina and Sakkari who couldn't do anything. Like they were doing their best. They couldn't do anything. Is this the kind of level that we're seeing from Collins that can be equivalent to the sort of tennis that we've been seeing Świątek and Sabalenka producing the last couple of years, 18 months?
There's still weaknesses to our game. That's the thing, Nick. I would still say that. So that would be maybe where I take a little step back and I go, right, okay, let's just maybe not get quite ahead of herself. There are still weaknesses in our game. She is beatable, I would say. Not a big fan of our forehand, for example, which I think can be a little passive compared to our backhand. And that is very, very inverted commas. Obviously, it's still a pretty aggressive shot, but the way she really goes after the backhand isn't quite the same as the forehand. And you get players who can exploit that. Again, I'm talking like three or four players in the world, and probably I would put them as the favourite. So, for example, if Collins comes up, well, Collins coming up against Swiatek is obviously a completely different thing on clay. Let's just, obviously, Swiatek is going to be the favourite there. But if you played somebody like Sabalenka or Rybakina, maybe with a bit more time on her shots, you know, against Collins' return, actually could benefit from the clay. I still put them the favourite, and I think it would be a really, really great match. But my point is, I don't think she's unbeatable. I think that's maybe my pinch of salt. I don't want to take anything away from her. I don't want to be the negative Nancy in this situation, Nick.
I'm not saying she's unbeatable. I don't think we're saying Danielle Collins is going to lose. I think I'm going to have some pinches of salt when we come to talking about her transition over to Europe. But in terms of the peak level that she has produced this last 3 weeks, because you talk about the forehand, I didn't see anything much passive about the forehand in Charleston. Not really in Miami, apart from when she got a little tight against serving it against Rybakina in a final. I think we did the final, didn't we? Which is why I was like, well, hang on, she's beaten Rybakina in a tough match. It was pretty like, okay, Rybakina wasn't her best that day, but it was still a good contest. I think that certainly during Charleston, I wasn't seeing that forehand backing off in any way. If anything, the arrows were coming from the backhand side. She was overhitting some of those cross courts. It was the only criticism I had of her. And that's Danielle Collins going for it like she does.
Yeah. I do think maybe some of the players she's played against this week, bar actually, and this is ironic because it's one of the most one-sided scorelines of the week, Barbadosa, I don't really think there were many other players that could put a ton of weight and pace into, like if you went forehand crosses, forehands cross court, I don't think there's many players this week that could have done that. Like Sakkari tends to get a bit tight in her forehand, Mertens prefers the backhand. Ons definitely struggles to produce pace in her forehand with it starting to slap it out basically. And then Sloane Stephens has just been so up and down. So there are other tests on the clay. Collins' level is worthy of the top 10, 100,000%. Yeah, I mean, that was your question, Nick, to be fair.
I mean, top 10. I guess I'm willing to go further and say top 5.
Top 5, yeah, absolutely. I wonder if the ELO ratings, Nick, reflect that. In fact, they do. I've just looked that up. So at the moment, if you went onto Tennis Abstract and look up your ELO ratings, which... for the tennis layman, ELO basically is something that takes into account the opponents you've beaten and spits out a kind of proper ranking, if that makes sense, reflective of who you're playing rather than, you know, the amount of points you've accrued over the last year. And Collins is in the top 5.
Yeah.
Is fifth. She is fifth, according to the ELO ratings. So you've still got Swiatek first, Rybakina second, Sabalenka third, and then Gauff fourth, and then shortly behind Collins.
Over what time period is that ELO?
It'll more heavily favour recent ratings, but it takes into account, you know, all ratings, okay. all tournaments. So yes, you know, even a 2022 match would count towards that ELO rating, but it would be so wouldn't be that high percentage amount to the end score, if that makes sense, Nick. So it will favour more recent bias more recent matches. It doesn't just take them into account, I guess, if that makes sense. But obviously the last 2 weeks has been pretty heavily influenced by ELO ratings, obviously, or the ELO ratings being heavily
influenced. I think ELO ratings have it about right. I'm reluctant to put Collins above fifth if I was to do a ranking based on what I've seen, like, because we haven't seen how she is against, you know, some of the other like members of the top four. And Rybakina on a better day than she had in Miami. I think it's fair to say, for Rybakina fans anyway.
That's somebody in the comments, Swarna, asking me to check the year ELO ratings, which does just take into account.
Which is why I was asking you about that, yeah.
Yeah, and Daniel Collins is first.
Who's second?
Iga.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, not surprised either. And then Rebecca in a third. And then Kalinskaya, fourth. So, yeah, I don't know. She has one good tournament.
It's like, Dubai, surely.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I don't know. And where's Paolini amongst all of this? You know, 14th? I don't know. Sounds a little bit far-fetched to me. But there you go. Collins first for the year, apparently.
You need to like be consistent on your presentation of ELO, Jack. Is it the real ranking or not?
I trust the to be quite honest, the fact that the yearly ELO ratings only consider the current year, I don't really. I suppose I don't know quite enough about. Oh no, I do. Sorry, there you go, Nick. The actual ELO rating does take into account the last 52 weeks.
Yeah,
so that's it. I'm so sorry, it doesn't count once before 52 weeks. I was totally wrong about that. So that does make a bit more sense. If I'm honest, Nick, I don't think Collins deserves first. It has only been 3 weeks. I mean, to a degree, it does also take into account how easily they won. So I suppose there's that. And I mean, the way she's been playing has just been phenomenal, obviously. And some of the scorelines have been heavily favourable for her. But I'm I agree with you, Nick. I think fifth.
But regardless of sort of where we're seeing where she's at in the bigger picture, she was clearly the best player in the Charleston draw. Like, no one could touch her. And no, we've jumped straight into her weaknesses, but they weren't really that on display apart from maybe overhitting a couple of times, which she tends to do. Yeah. That's how she plays. Even Rybakina and Sabalenka overhit on their best days. But it was just that sort of step above that no one could do anything with it. And she was just, I mean, the winners she was producing against Kasatkina, who usually can get to most balls, was incredible.
Yeah. Quick sort of sidebar, by the way. Kasatkina getting into final for the third time this year, obviously quite commendable. It surprised me that is the second final on clay of Kasatkina's career. And the first one came in 2017.
At Charleston?
Yeah, at Charleston.
Yeah, and she won it.
I suppose the explanation for that is on clay, the surface that kind of levels the pushers and the power, I would say Kasatkina beats pretty much everybody she's ranked to higher than, and then in a semi-final against Iga or Sabalenka, there's a power deficit, and that's maybe why she gets beaten on clay. That's
which is what happened to her in 2022 at the French Open.
Yeah, yeah.
Although interestingly, that Charleston final, she beat Ostapenko, who then went on to win the French.
Yeah, but then that's Ostapenko, Nick. Any discussion of just like reasonability, leave Ostapenko out of it. You know, we're speaking logic here. Ostapenko is always just going to make no sense.
Although Kira and I did the final, we said we really want to see a Collins versus Ostapenko match, ideally in Madrid.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah,
that would be fantastic to watch.
Yeah, well, or potentially awful. It depends.
It could be potentially awful, but like I'm looking at how good it could be, and I knowing full well what it could be. But like, yeah, that's any tennis match, right? How many tennis epics have we had? Like, we've even had Fedal matches on the men's side that have ended up being duds.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's true. Look ahead for Collins, because I want to talk a little bit about Madrid. And the reason I think Madrid could be very favourable for Daniel Collins.
I completely agree with you. Like, this is exactly what I was like. How confident are you that she takes this form into European clay? Because I think if she starts with Madrid, that altitude and the way that it doesn't hinder the power players, that's going to help her a lot.
Yeah. The other reason, obviously, I feel like it benefits power players, because if you hit the ball hard in Madrid, it does ping. It's tough to control for the other player. But the other thing I thought a lot of players get a lot of purchase in Madrid from playing sort of high, kind of loopy kick serves and stuff, or high loopy balls in the rally and stuff. And that's where Collins excels. She'll take the ball in from up high and she'll absolutely lace it every single time. That is like her bread and butter. So, I mean, if she keeps doing that, it's a... Yes, she can do that on other surfaces, but there are other players that can do that on other surfaces. And I feel like Collins is one of the few that loves that kind of like high backhand shot. So if she did play Iga, I think we could see something similar to the Australian Open, where obviously her second serve was just getting absolutely demolished. But then there's other things going on with the Iga-Collins rivalry, and I do feel like Iga's kind of worked out a little bit.
The Iga-Collins rivalry is interesting because Iga beats her 8 times out of 10, and then the other 2 times, Danielle shows up and really causes her problems.
Yeah, exactly. So on paper, you're right. On paper, Collins should be a pretty big threat for Swiatek. She's one of the few players that can rush her. But then again, this is where I'm talking about like the best players in the world and their forehands compared to Collins. That's just like an uphill battle every single time against Iga.
I think Collins is a threat to Iga in Madrid. I will say that because Alexandrova was a threat to her briefly in Madrid. Yeah. Sabalenka, we saw what happened with that. That was a really close battle. I think clay gives Iga a foothold that she doesn't have on other situations like that, given that she's more comfortable moving on it. I definitely think if Collins is in Iga's half of the draw, her fans will be concerned. The matchup I really, really would be most interested in seeing, Iga Danielle, you kind of have an idea of what you're going to get. Arena Danielle in Madrid, I'm not sure what would happen.
I want to see that. Yeah, that would be good. That's exactly what I want to see as well, Mick. Daniel Collins, Arena Sabalenka, Madrid final, after Collins somehow upsets Iga in the semi-final. That's what I want.
Yeah. I can't say I want that, but that would be an interesting story.
And there are... I actually was really impressed with how Ons dealt with Danielle this week. You know, so she's, again, one of the few players who can kind of give her a different look and doesn't just, like, give her time to just keep hitting power balls, basically. You know, Ons and clay is very, very exciting to watch when she's on. No pun intended.
Yeah.
Drop shots galore. You know, that's the kind of stuff that could... I mean, Ons in Madrid, did she win it 2 years ago or 3 years ago? I've lost track.
2 years ago, 2022, because that was the one Iga skipped.
Yes, so it was. She was amazing. She was so good. That match against Halep in the semi-final. Just the kind of player who could really cause some problems. So bar a few banana skins like Ons, I think Collins could do really well.
I actually said after, I think I might have, no, I think I came right at the end of that match she had with Collins. And we were on a bit of a tangent, but let's talk about Ons. I actually thought that was Ons' most positive loss that she's had for quite some time. She was in it and competing. And I think she was just unfortunate that Danielle Collins was producing another level of tennis. But I think that she should take far more positives than negatives out of that result.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, she's the kind of player that when she loses, it doesn't look particularly pretty. You know, again, a lot of slap forehands. We're talking about how flat that forehand is and a lot of choices that are just like, what the... you know, what's going on. But that is very odds, obviously.
Thank you for moderating the first chat.
Yeah, when it all works. It's a joy to watch. So, I feel like if she is going to kind of hit her stride again after a pretty poor year, Madrid would be one of the best places to start with it, for sure.
One more question I want to ask about Danielle Collins before we move on to the rest of the field in Charleston. Because let's face it, Charleston was Danielle Collins and the rest. Do you think, because she's currently on the entry list for it, do you think she should play Stuttgart qualifying or do you think she should pull out?
Sorry, you cut out there, Nick.
Danielle Collins should play Stuttgart qualifying or not? Because she's the second seed in qualifying. Mm-hmm. It's a stacked entry list. She has.
Oh my god! Yeah. I totally forgot how like insanely stacked Stuttgart is like every year. It's literally just got like the top 30, and that's about it, basically. I mean, she. I'm just looking at the live ranking. She's 15 in the world. She has to play qualifying in Stuttgart. It's insane. There's like no other tennis tournament in the world that's like that. Genuinely. Like it's actually
it's to do with the fact that obviously when she entered, she was outside the top 50.
I know. Oh, really? Yeah, right. I thought they used the ranking from the previous week. Sorry, I didn't know.
No, that. It's 4 weeks from the start of the tournament is the entry.
Right.
Cutoff,
so, gotcha. Well, in that case, you're justifiably in the qualifying. I would say, yeah, play it. Like she'll be absolutely fine against whoever she plays.
Get into the draw, get some wins into about, because Collins and Stuttgart would be interesting.
Yeah, I think so too. But then there obviously, you know, the reason she's retiring is because of health issues, and some of them may be undisclosed, and obviously family as well. But I think there's other stuff going on, and maybe she'll be keen to temper her schedule and maybe not just dive straight into another tournament. So probably my gut feeling is she doesn't play it.
That's my gut feeling as well. I think that, like, hey, she's gotten to the top 15. She doesn't need to grind things out. She's going to get a good seeding in Madrid. I think a big chunk of why she's retiring is that she doesn't enjoy the grind of the tour anymore. And that's the one caveat that is the most unknowable on, like, seeing her moving on to the next, like, moving on to European clay. I see no reason, tennis-wise, that she can't continue this form. But this is something we just don't know, because it's completely up to Danielle in her head and her body, whatever it is, that how she's going to deal with being out of her comfort zone, of being out of the US, about being away from kind of on the road again. And like, she's done it before. She'll cope with it. She's a professional. But it's going to be about sort of how that affects the tennis that she can produce.
Yeah. Totally agreed. So yeah, most likely, yeah, we don't see her in the draw for Stuttgart, which, you know, actually she probably would have done quite well there as well. Again, fairly quick relative to other clay tournaments. But to be honest, the WTA have a pretty big problem in that there's not that many slow clay tournaments. So when you get into Roland Garros and it's like the only slow clay tournament they've played the whole year, Iga's like rubbing her hands, like, nobody's warmed up for this. Like, my like base level is just like perfect for this surface. Like, I'm quite zen pretty much every year.
What about Rome?
Rome's, yeah, you do have Rome, of course. Yeah, sorry. But that's literally the only other big event, yeah, I would say. Because you're missing your ATP's equivalent of Monte Carlo in the draw somewhere, basically. And the same with Barcelona as well, which is fairly slow too.
Yeah. This is... yeah, that's the case. And yeah, it's a weird... WTA on clay is a strange... but here we go. So, rest of the field. Let's go with the finest. We mentioned her earlier, Daria Kasatkina. Third final of the year. Third time into the 500 final. Third time she runs into a red-hot player. Do you think that What the Vlog will feature her celebrating a title this year?
She has been pretty unlucky. But I mean, you look at it, there's like a couple of finals she lost last year as well, and, you know, against beatable opponents, got absolutely thumped by Bencic in the Adelaide final, and close against Madison Keys, but didn't actually come away with a set. I do think Kasatkina comes into finals a lot of the time as the player to beat. You know, she kind of gives she lets the opponent dictate the match a lot of the time. And actually, although Kasatkina is kind of known as a bit of a pusher, she actually does have some pretty decent power in the forehand. So I would quite like to see her really going for it and not just sitting back, especially in a matchup like freaking Danielle Collins, where the serve is just going to get absolutely annihilated. Like, it's got to be a bit more aggressive, I think. So,
like, she started winning points and like threatening Danielle's service games and holding serve when she started swinging for it. And again, this is something that Kira and I picked up on the commentary and like talked about, was Kasatkina can hit big, but she often chooses not to. And we don't necessarily know why. I don't know if anyone's ever asked her about it. maybe it's something she doesn't feel like she can sustain, be it like level wise or physicality wise. I compared her to Medvedev in that respect, and that again, he can hit through it but chooses not to. Albeit his technique is, I'd say Kazakhina's probably got a better technique than he does, or a more teachable technique. But I'm just wondering whether it's if that's the scenario. But again, I don't know if anyone's asked her about it. Because, yeah, that's the question. She can do it. Why doesn't she do it that often?
Well, it's, you know, for a player like Medvedev, getting players into that backhand cross-court pattern, very, very few players can beat him from there. So few. So for him to not take a risk from there makes total sense, because is Medvedev going to miss a backhand cross-court? Nah, it's just not going to happen. So immediately you get a player into that position, they're the one that has to take a risk. They have to go down the line. They have to come up with something different. And, you know, if you don't go into the down the line with enough power, you're into the Medvedev's forehand. That's danger territory because you've opened up the court. So it's just like, it makes sense for Medvedev to be totally passive and just like let his opponent dictate what's going on, because so often the other player can't come up with something. For Kazakhina, it's very classic WTA in that a lot of our shots are a lot more shapy than, say, a Medvedev. You know, they're very loopy. They do sit up. They are attackable. They're deep. You know, they're consistent. They're not going to miss. But if the opponent's feeling it on the day, it's a lot easier to attack that ball than a player like Medvedev's. So she knows for a fact she's not going to miss, because she's got like lovely, lovely topspin on every single shapy ball that she hits. But there's the risk that the other player's feeling it on the day. And it's a bigger risk for her than, say, somebody like Medvedev, who just sets up a total backhand jail, basically.
But when it works for Kazakhina, it really works and often produces really, really good matches, even though she loses. I'm thinking about the match she had with Garcia at the WT Finals in 2022. I'm thinking about the match she had with Rybakina last year in Montreal. And the match she had with Jessica Pegula, which she actually won really tightly. And that was because she just would not let Pegula pull away and just kept on going. And I really enjoyed watching it, because it was a battle between two really consistent ball strikers, and you're going to get some really, really good rallies. And at first it was a battle of who wasn't going to miss, and then it was a battle of who actually had some variety to offset the other player. And basically who ended up having a bit more grit and determination in that one. But yeah, when Kazakhina, that semi-final with Pegula, to me that was a sign of like how she still got herself into a top 20 ranking, a peak top 10 ranking with the game that she has.
Yeah, she's not going to, like Medvedev, she's not going to miss, but it's a ball that is attackable compared to his. It does end up making the other player play well, I think, which is why a lot of Kazakhina's matches do end up being quite like high quality, I think. Because again, Kazakhina won't miss, but the other player is forced to come up with something pretty spectacular, or basically construct a point, play actual tennis instead of just like Ostapenkoing it. And it ends up being like pretty entertaining stuff.
Yeah. Speaking of Pegula, do you think this week was signs of her getting back on track? She gritted her way through two deciding set tie breaks, including saving match points against Azarenka. Got the name right this time. For those of you who know, you know. And then narrowly losing to Kazakhina, again, deciding set tiebreak. And you're probably thinking, well, yeah, she had to scrap her way through the draw, but like she was losing these sort of matches throughout this year up to this point. And she seems to have now remembered how to win ugly again. And that might be able to, I'm optimistic that that would help her rediscover the winning consistent form that she's shown the last couple of years has got her to top 3, 4, 5 in the world.
Yeah, maybe so. Pegula's quite an interesting one when you talk about winning ugly. It's not something I would generally associate with her. I've always thought of her tennis as very pure. She's a very kind of clean ball striker. You know what I mean? Like on return, just amazing hitting sometimes, but if she's a bit off, then, you know, that can get a little bit ropey. And we kind of saw something a little bit different this week. You know, she was mixing up a little bit and as you say, gritting her teeth in some really, really kind of clutch moments. I would say so. That's two very, very good wins. I'll be maybe not against, I mean, Anisimova is obviously a great clay court player on her day, but still maybe not somebody I would associate with clay courts, and same with Azarenka. They're good players nonetheless. I don't want to take too much away from her. I would say that Pegula's definitely needed some wins like that to kind of get back on track, and I kind of felt the same about Miami as well, even though maybe the field wasn't quite as strong as it was this week in Charleston. I love seeing Pegula playing well. Like, I really do want to see her kind of challenging players at the top of the game again, and I'm sure it'll come. She's a good enough ball striker.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what she does. And again, Pegula is one of those players that you would sit, if you're coaching someone, you want to show them footage of tennis, you sit them down, you say, watch Pegula as your primer, as a consistent. It's not necessarily going to be, it's not always world beating. In fact, it rarely is, but in terms of, you know, beating the top four people up there, Goff, she seems to, you know, have a good record with, but the other three is a bit more of a fight. I agree. I think if Pegula gets back, it's going to be good to watch. Ghost is probably absolutely loving us right now. I would be up for that. Someone else who already kind of seems back on track, probably because she's just taken Pegula's coach, is Maria Sakkari, who, if we think about her last three tournaments, final, quarterfinal, semi-final, lost to the three form players in those matches, and definitely seems to be moving herself into consistency, question mark? Is she the new Pegula?
The new Pegula, She's been playing well. She's been playing better than she used to, for sure. I would say it doesn't feel like she's gone into those big matches. And I mean, you look at the score lines, I guess, against Swiatek and Collins, but I don't know. I don't think she played that badly, to be honest, compared to, you know, people kind of always talk about her semi-final record. It didn't really feel like a case of nerves. She does seem to have kind of shaken that a little bit, and I've been very impressed with her. Very impressed with her. And, you know, every single time I'm quite surprised to see her, like, making the latter stages of a third tournament in a row. And but then maybe I shouldn't be so surprised. All the ingredients are there. It's just been a case of kind of giving her a bit of confidence, right? And so often it was just that forehand side. And there was quite a lot of discussion about that. I can't remember where I saw that, sorry. But obviously with her previous coach, and how kind of negative he was a lot of the time, and like kind of talking about the fact that she should kind of do stuff to cover up her weaknesses rather than playing to her strengths. And I think that was the kind of wording that she really didn't like, and it didn't really work for her. And she did end up just getting a little bit worse with her forehand when things did get tight. And I obviously think the pairing here she has with, you'll have to remember the coach's name of Pegula, I can't remember.
David Witt.
That's it, sorry. With David's probably going to be obviously we see it's fruitful. So it's good stuff now. But again, I'm not too surprised.
Yeah. So I guess with Sakkari, we shouldn't be surprised, and she's showing it. And what's been interesting, like when you're saying that, is first of all, she's beating players that she should be beating, which she wasn't consistently doing the last couple of years. Like Charleston, she carved her way through the draw, and then she just happened to run into, again, red hot Daniel Collins. The matches she lost against Iga in Indian Wells and Collins were very similar, in that she got knocked aside by a fast start, worked her way back into the set, and then got stomped on again. Which none of those things were really in her control, but there was a sense of unraveling. I think she unraveled less against Collins than she did against Iga. Mm-hmm. I think there's definitely a pattern to those defeats of, you know, she's there, she's in the mix, she's trying to compete. there's obviously a level up, but I think there's hope for her pulling off some big wins in there.
Yeah, just a comment as well from John, just as a rebuttal. It was quite a tight loss, I guess, in Miami against Rybakina, but again, she kept things close, and I thought she was serving pretty well generally. And again, that serve doesn't really get talked about that much. I think Sakkari, when she's serving well, has one of the genuinely one of the best serve, well, a top 10 serve for me when she's serving well, which isn't always the case, but I definitely think it's right up there.
Is that to do with it being a really good spot serve?
Yeah, I think she places it really well, particularly the T1 in the juice court, which is nice and flat, you know, really, really shoots through the court. And then nice defense on her second serve as well. But particularly just the power she gets in the flat serve is really impressive. But I do see John's point kind of bringing it up. You know, there's still the same ghosts, and she still needs to get over that. And being a Sakkari fan is obviously exhausting. And but she's putting herself in that position a bit more often than she has been in maybe previous seasons, at least more consistently. So kind of like last season where she eventually got that breakthrough in Guadalajara, I'm sure she's going to make another deep run, a proper deep run, a final, maybe a win in the near future.
Right. Well, I guess before we wrap up Charleston, which actually for me was a really, really good event because you had a really, really good match almost every day. And the days where you didn't, I think the only exception maybe being the final, where you just had to stand in awe of the incredible level of tennis being produced by the winner. I think it's been a really, really good tournament in terms of action and quality. That's my overall kind of how I want to finish off thinking about Charleston. So you can come on to that as well. But like, are there any other kind of player stories that you want to make sure we don't overlook before we move on?
No, not off the top of my head. Obviously, Collins, Kasatkina, Pegula were the main ones. Sakkari a bit as well. So, nothing off the top of my head, Nick.
Okay, cool. Well, I really enjoyed Charleston. I'm looking forward to watching it again next year. But there was one other event going on at the same time that got massively overlooked in the Charleston hype, and that was Bogota, which saw a home champion as Tatiana Maria, who had a cast iron grip on that event the last 2 years, was unseated by the event. I think she was unseated by the eventual champion. I'm hoping I remember that right. Camila Osorio, who I have to say, I don't know, I caught, she beat Maria from a set down. Camila Osorio, who stormed to the title and was really fired up in that final against Bushkova and was really going for her shots in it in a way that I haven't really associated with Osorio before. I kind of tend to see her as a bit more of a grinder, kind of standard clay court player, like Sloane like the Radis, bit more of a Kasatkina type. So to see her kind of going for it was pretty impressive, but she clearly really, really wanted this title.
Yeah. She's not a soft hitter. She does hit big. The reason she's such a good clay courter, well, not the reason she's not so good off of clay is that she doesn't have a serve. Like, she does not have a serve to speak of. It is literally just every single thing is sliced into the court. It's quite a WTA oddity that you can get into the top 100 without really having an aggressive serve. But again, you know, obviously it's testament, let's spin it positively, it's testament to how well she plays at the baseline. She's a fantastic baseliner, and she doesn't lack anything from the back of the court, for sure. Couple of other reasons as well, though. I mean, obviously the fact that she's Colombian, I'm sure, helps a bit. You know, just having, like, growing up in altitude, and it helps you just get your eye in when the ball's bouncing about like that, Nick.
Yeah, it does. Also, the crowd was a huge factor. Like, she and the crowd were just, playing off each other all the time, yeah. Firing each other up.
Yeah, it's a bit of both. And I actually, Buzkova, the finalist, is one of those players that also absolutely loves altitude. So maybe that was just the little difference. You know, they were both altitude players, but Osorio just feeding off the crowd, that little bit of a difference is all it takes sometimes. Obviously, I know you kind of mentioned that, but I don't know if you said Osorio also won in 2021. So it's basically
She has won a title, yeah.
In Bogota.
Was it Bogota? Thought it was a hard... I don't know why I thought it was a Mexican event she'd won.
So the 2020s have been a stranglehold of Maria and Osorio in Bogota. But obviously, where Maria, I think it's obvious to me why she's good in altitude. But I'll enlighten you if you're not 100% sure.
Go for it.
The slice is lethal in altitude. It's lethal. So where topspin doesn't dip the ball as much as it would in altitude because the air is thinner, it actually has the opposite effect on slice because it's spinning the other way. So it's going to be much harder for you to pick that ball up off of the ground compared to a slice, you know, say in Monte Carlo where you're literally sea level. So Maria slicing in Colombia, she can just slice all day and the opponent won't feel like they can do anything against her. The ball will just absolutely fly off the strings. And Osorio actually does play a bit of slice herself. You know, she relies on that a little bit every so often. She's actually not a stranger to it. It's obviously not the foundation of her game, that she is able to do that. And I feel like she's a very good feeler of the ball compared to a lot of players, which is why we get that kind of grindy sense off of her. She's hitting the ball big, but she really, really misses. You know, like she's not much of an unforced error sprayer.
A bit like Pegula, but without a serve.
Yeah, a bit like Pegula, but without a serve. Yeah, that's a pretty good way to describe her, I would say. Not quite as flat a hitter as Pegula, but close, like not that far off. It's quite interesting because again she doesn't play like the same kind of top spin as Kasatkina, but it's almost like the time helps her a wee bit, like the time on the ball helps her just like stay steady, and she plays a bit flat, but again just not in much danger of missing. She's a very talented player, despite the fact she's got no serve.
You know what, you're talking about Camila Osorio without having a serve does remind me of a conversation we had I can't remember on another show at some point about Ostapenko's lack of serve and a similar thing of Ostapenko hits a lot like even bigger and the strengths of her ground game are for different reasons, but is that a fair comparison of someone who makes up for the lack of serve with other weapons, having said that Ostapenko has improved her serve a little bit?
Just Ostapenko is I never like making Ostapenko comparisons because she just is Ostapenko and there's no comparison. Osorio is not Ostapenko for sure.
Well, let's round off on Osorio then before we move on to the action coming up in tennis. So I remember Osorio when she came onto the scene, like around that time she won in Bogota in 2021. And as around the time I was really getting into the WTA as like one of the big young prospects coming through. Like she's 22 now. 3 years ago, she would have been 19, like one of the big names kind of coming through. And I think our conversation is kind of enlightened as to why maybe she's not kept herself in that category with the kind of other teenagers, kind of similar age people who are now pushing themselves more in the mix. Are we expecting that to continue to be her career trajectory?
I don't think she's going to add anything to her game. I don't think she's necessarily going to take off from here. I definitely think she's the kind of player that could actually do really well at a big clay court tournament. You know, again, Madrid at altitude, it really isn't just because it's in Colombia. She really is a good player at altitude just because she feels the ball so well. Obviously, one of her other finals was Monterrey, which again is a pretty high altitude. So I do think she could make a deep run at a big tournament because of her talent, but I don't think she's going to add many strings to her bow, and I do think she's maybe destined for like top 30, Nick, that kind of...
She's been very close to, I think she's career high 33, so right. she can get back there again. So watch out for her in Madrid, maybe. Madrid's got altitude, albeit probably plays a little bit quicker than Bogota. All right. Well, I think
one other player as well, just to mention before we move on, is Sarah Arani, who made the semi-finals of obviously WTA 250. Yeah. Yes.
Every time I see Arani is playing, my first thought is, how is she still going?
Okay, exactly. Likewise, if we're talking about players without serves, oh my god!
How did she make the Grand Slam final?
I mean, this is the thing. She's obviously a great hitter of the ball, and there are certain conditions where you don't need to have a big, massive serve in WTA tennis. And obviously, I mean, there's also certain players as well. So Arani versus Sarah Suribas Torma this week.
That's obviously one. Where, that.
Yeah, it's obviously one where you don't need big serves. Just like 50 short rallies and stuff, you know, 3 hour match.
That was like watching like two clones of each other. very similar. Matches. Sure, she was underarm serving towards the end. It was kind of madness, really. But it's the kind of madness those two could produce when played against each other.
Arani is an insane player. It's always very encouraging for club players watching her. You know, she gets like the yips on her tosses and stuff. And I mean, the first serve percent, I'm just looking at the first serve points won this week. It's just barely ever ticking over 50%, which just says to me it's an even Stevens rally pretty much every time. And yeah, encouraging for a lot of the club players out there, I think.
Indeed.
I can no disrespect, but it's just like, you know, ugly tennis basically is beautiful in a way.
I agree. There's something about a moon ball rally that's quite impressive.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like, that's, you know, if that's going to win you the point, then take notes. Like, don't try not to just like play, you know, big slappy tennis and hope the ball goes in. Like, take notes. These guys are winning points by doing it, you know.
And as club players, if you do try and slap the ball, it's not going to go in. Trust me, we know this.
Exactly.
So you can watch Sara Saribas tournament, watch Sara Arani. They'll get you somewhere. Right. So technically, we don't have WTA this week, but there's still women's tennis happening because it's been a Billie Jean King Cup. So we do have boots on the ground for the Europe Africa Group 1 ties that are taking place for the qualifiers in Group 1. Obviously, winners going into the playoffs to have a chance at the qualifiers next year. There are three pools of four nations each. There's 12 countries involved and some pretty big players. And I think we've already got some footage that we can show you that we've already got.
I am Francisca George, and I'm a friend of the show.
Perfect. Thanks.
There we go. Francisca George, who is obviously a Portuguese player, lost to Yelena Ostapenko today, but did take a set offer.
I take it there wasn't any guns to the head or anything like that, or when she was saying this.
I mean, you'd have to ask the six and the third. Good grief. I don't know because I don't know if that's being broadcast.
Sorry.
Ask the person who was there watching it.
Yes, sorry. Of course. A friend of the show. She seemed very genuine, to be fair. I'm sure she is.
So yeah, we do have a there's some. I think there's a full interview out there, which is brilliant. Latvia beat Portugal 3-0. Unsurprisingly, Netherlands beat Turkey 2-1. In that players in action. You've got obviously Ostapenko is playing for Latvia. You've got Clara Towson and Caroline Wozniacki leading out Denmark. Maria Sakkari is playing for Greece. So there's a few, I think those are the big names that are happening. Depending on whether people can actually access this and watch it, I don't know. And we'll move on to sort of the bigger name countries in a minute. But looking at sort of who's in the pool, so Austria, Hungary, Bulgaria, Denmark, Latvia, Netherlands, Turkey, Portugal, Serbia, Greece, Sweden, Norway. Is it a done deal that the three countries coming through the pools are going to be Denmark, Latvia, and Greece? Or do we think there's a possibility of things getting a bit mixed up here.
I'll be honest. I'm trying to see the draw, and I just can't. I can't find it on Billie Jean.
You do have to like.
They've never had a good website. I remember this every single year. I'm trying to find out who's playing where, and you're saying all these countries, and I cannot see any of them. I can't see Denmark.
I've got it in front of me.
Can you do a wee screen share, and then
I can do that. Yeah.
My thoughts.
Yeah. Do you mind? I'm sure producer won't mind me taking over screen share for a bit. So let's have a look. So this is obviously the names that you'll be hearing from our boots on the ground in Portugal. But yeah, so here are the teams. I'll show you the draws in a minute, but like these are the names.
There we go.
Can you see it big enough?
Yeah, I can. Obviously Denmark stands out. But to be fair, I remember the days when I was so big in Claretouse and what's happened, you know, come on. Like, I was thinking
too much.
Yeah, obviously injury, I know. But she's had a fair while to come back from that now. And the consistency just isn't really coming for her, which is a shame because she's a top 10 prospect for sure. I mean, the way she hits the ball is just fabulous, honestly. Right, keep going down if you wouldn't mind, Nick. Obviously, some of the Greek players besides Sakari are playing well as well, by the way. I wouldn't sleep on Papa Michael and Mitikapolu as well.
Well attended
and all. And then Semenis Staja, how do you pronounce her name again? For Latvia as well. But obviously they've been and gone, did you see, Nick?
So Latvia, so it's a group stage. So they've got to play each other. So I'll show you the groups in a minute.
I see.
But Latvia beat Portugal 3-0, and you can see, you've got the Dutch, Norwegian, Portuguese teams here. You are kind of looking like you've got Arantha Roos, who's an established top 100 player, and Helgo, who made a bit of an impact in the United Cup.
Don't forget about Shows as well, I suppose. Obviously in the doubles. Yeah, that's, I can't imagine there's a whole bunch of top 10 players in these countries. So Shows is probably one of the few.
Yeah, I'd say the only top 10 players in action are Ostapenko and Sakari. Then obviously you've got Potential and Towson and former in Wozniacki. So you can see the pools here. So pool A is Austria, Hungary, Bulgaria and Denmark. Denmark's actually lost their opening tie. They actually lost 2-1 to Austria.
All right. Okay. That's unexpected.
They're in trouble.
Grabber, I suppose. Grabber's pretty good.
Yeah, Grabher was someone I thought maybe we're kind of ruling her out a bit. Let's have a look, see what was their what was the result. So Kraus beat Wozniacki. Oh, Wozniacki retired without winning a game.
Oh, and Towson won against Grabher.
Towson beat Grabher, who's obviously Towson's the higher ranked player, and then Austria beat them in the doubles. But that could be a bit of a blow for Denmark if they've lost Wozniacki, and might be somewhat concerned if Wozniacki wasn't able to win a game and retired after 30 minutes on clay.
Okay.
Bit of a breaking news. Keep an eye on Wozniacki's comeback there.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting that. And then Netherlands able to beat Turkey, but obviously not a whole bunch of Turkish players in the public eye, really.
So Latvia should come through this group.
And then that's an interesting group below that, if we check that
Serbia
out.
Serbia, Greece, Sweden, Norway, Serbia won 3-0 against Norway, and then Greece beat Sweden 2-1.
Yeah, it's probably going to be those two teams that are playing for it, right? Trying to think about the Swedish players nowadays, Rebecca.
Someone who comes to mind, but I think she's dropped down quite far. No, she's not playing. It's Jacqueline Cabrawad.
Oh, right. Okay. So, yeah, definitely Serbia. And but even then, looking at the Serbian team, it's not particularly... I mean, Greece have got to come through, right?
Yeah, Greece should come through that.
Stjanovic, has she got any form at the moment?
Hard to say. I think they definitely got a decent doubles team in there, Serbia.
Yeah, so I fancy Greece to get through, not even with Sakari. I think the other two players in their team are pretty solid as well. But obviously, anything can really happen, especially in clay. Then was the one group there we were missing.
Yes, so let's go to the qualifiers, which I believe is what they're technically called, because obviously this is to get into the finals that will be happening at the end of the year. So I'm just going to share my screen again. There we go. And yeah, so there you go. There's your world group ties. And you're probably going to be seeing, well, I was going to say you're probably going to be seeing some bigger names. I did actually do a little brief preview on the Ground Pass podcast with Anastasia of the USA versus Belgium. And we looked at the lineup and yeah, none of Belgium's players in the top 100, whereas the US have sent Pegula, Keys, and Navarro, and Townsend.
All right, okay. Wow.
I think Goff is in there as well.
All right, cool.
No, she's not. No, Goff's not there. They sent Dulhide. So, yeah.
That's yeah, you can see that. Team for
none of them is in the top 200. Mercy to go.
Jesus, and then obviously Taylor Townsend, your worst player. That's pretty good. Jeez, oh. Yeah, that's an impressive lineup from the USA, I guess.
I don't envy the Belgian team to have to go to Orlando in the US and try and take down that team.
Yeah, oh my God. Well, that's going to be a lambs to the slaughter, I think. Bencic isn't playing for Belgium.
No, let's have a look. So Iga's playing for Poland. She's in the team, along with Freck and Lynette. So that's actually a really, really strong Polish team. Swiss do have Golubic and Teichmann.
I mean, Golubic, the two of them, just no chance against Iga. That's just not a good matchup for either of them, particularly that one-hander, which is just going to get absolutely battered. Fretch and Lynette never really been the biggest power players. There's upset ability there for sure, but Iga will beat that team to a victory for sure. Even in the doubles, I think. She's actually alright at doubles, like she's not particularly bad or anything, so I'm sure they'll probably get her playing the dubs and see where she goes from there.
Yeah, so there you go. So I think, yeah, that's the big name in action is obviously Iga. Is Elena playing in the Kazakhstan team? She's not. They're being Yedvad, Putin, Safer. Whereas the Japanese team have got Osaka.
Well, okay. Okay, cool. That's obviously interesting. And now Hibino as well, you know, she won a title last year, not to be underrated. And Putin Safer, I mean, the one of the pushiest of the pushers for sure. Actually, Putin Safer, she can hit the ball. But again, my point is she can get beaten by anybody on their day as well. So that's, yeah, Japan should be the favourites there.
Yeah, that one should go away, but like, yeah, if they could deploy Osaka, yeah, Kazakhstan are in trouble. Looking at this lineup of nations, and obviously we're not necessarily digging deep into every single team, the tie that's catching my eye as the one that's got the most potential for a blockbuster, and I'm not just saying this because of the country I'm from, is France versus DB.
Yeah, I agree. I think obviously having your top two players for both teams Harriet Dart, maybe I think some might argue, just if you're not from Britain, maybe you're not as big on her, but certainly Garcia Bolter as two top 30 players, that's your biggest, your highest ranking matchup, right? And I mean, if both players, I think both players indoors, we're clay, of course, aren't we? Never mind.
Yeah, they are playing clay. That's the thing. Bolts are on clay.
Okay. Well, well, they've got Paddy. Our team aren't particularly great for clay, Nick.
But we have just added Fran Jones. So it's not updating the website, but it's been announced today that Fran Jones is joining the team.
I mean, is Fran Jones a clay court grinder?
Fran Jones is really, really good on clay. She just reached the clay one WTA 125K final. She made the semis in Bogota last year.
All right, okay. Didn't know that, Fran.
She is our clay specialist.
Well, I mean, if Fran Jones is our clay specialist, then.
But yeah, okay. On clay, it doesn't look great. But, we got some. We pushed the Czechs last year. The GB pushed the Czechs. Maybe not so much von Drusova, but you know, Martinsova is probably similar sort of level to Parry and Burrell.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. We'll see. Yeah, I'm not saying we don't have a chance. I actually fancy Harriet Dart's chances more than anybody else. Heather's just been playing a wee bit too rough. And I suppose, actually, Emma.
Yeah, Dart on clay is actually, you know, she quizzed herself well in GB tie last year. And Emma Raducanu, I don't think she's that bad on clay.
She was kind of working it out, I feel, though, and I don't know if she has quite worked it out yet. Obviously, the movement's very different, and it's just not quite as sure as she's probably used to, having not grown up on the surface. So, Nick, I'm not going to be too big on that one, I think. I do want to get into it, but I'm keeping my expectations a little lower than yours.
Let me say this. Okay, I am not here to predict GB are going to beat France on home on clay. In their backyard on clay. That's not necessarily what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, if you're looking for the opportunity for a roller coaster blockbuster tie, that's probably your best hope out of the ones that we've got.
I mean, they're good team players, so you're right, Nick. They could kind of dig in and come up with some pretty crazy results.
I mean, so. Maybe depends on who's playing in Ukraine and Romania.
Yeah, I was just looking at that. So we've got Svitolina, Surenko. That's a lovely lineup for Ukraine. And then Christian, Bogdan, both solid players on their day.
Christian. Charleston.
Yeah, I was going to say she's getting momentum back after obviously having been out of injury. So, I didn't know Takao was captaining the team as well. Yeah. Obviously, forgotten he'd retired. There you go. So, say that again, sorry.
Halep's in there.
What? Oh, yes, there she is. Ranked number 1,143. Totally missed her. Yeah. Didn't even look that far down the lineup.
They've got a Halep to deploy potentially against Svitolina, which those two on clay have a history.
Oh, that would be good. That would be great. Oh, there you go. That's your matchup, surely.
Yeah, which you can see on Tennis Channel International. It's how you watch Billie Jean King Cup.
I mean, Halep's got to be a bit rusty, obviously. It could be really shocking.
It would be. Although she won the first against Badosa, I think that's, I mean, obviously, I think she just came out swinging in that, but.
Yeah.
I think that's your best hope.
That does bode well, to be fair. Does it feel weird a bit talking about Halep coming back, or is that.
We could talk about it. I mean, like we've talked about her a little bit. I don't know. We've discussed. I don't think actually I got the opportunity to talk about Halep coming back with Marcus. I think we did a little bit as the preview to Miami in that episode. No, that was Kira. Kira and I were generally positive about the idea of Simona Halep being on tour, given the quality of player that she is and the reputation that she has. But yeah, where are you at with Halep being back on tour?
Yeah, it's maybe a bit of a bad taste in the mouth. And I don't know. I just don't know. I don't know if she's guilty or not. And it's just hard to say, isn't it?
It's one of those, like, we know she ingested something she shouldn't have. The question is, what was the circumstance, the exact circumstance? I was about to make a crack about Roxa Dunst having a bit of taste in their mouth, but I don't actually know that for a fact.
It would have worked. I don't know, Nick. I really don't know. I'm going to let the chat decide that one, I think.
I think we already have a little bit of an inkling from some in the chat for this. I'm not a big fan of the circumstance of her coming back, and I know it's going to be discussed all the time now, every time. Was a little bit with Sharapova as well, although Sharapova didn't really return at the level she left with, and I guess the question is whether Simona Halep, the same thing's going to happen with her.
Yeah, Sharapova's almost seemed a bit more damning. I feel like she didn't really fight it that much. It was almost like, yeah, I did. I'll hold my hands up. You know, that is what happened. Where Halep was very adamant that she hadn't done anything wrong. So, yeah, and you're right, Nick. She did do something wrong, but whether she did that willingly, whether she did it consciously. I could be persuaded that she did not do it knowingly, basically, Nick.
Okay. Yeah, I'm reserving judgment on it. I'm just going to let her tennis do the talking now. And yeah, I think it's going to be one of those. It's not going to go away, and people are always going to be suspicious of whenever she wins now. But I also feel like if you're dumb enough to dope twice, you don't deserve to play professional sport.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's fair. That's a fair point. I think with Sharapova as well, there is an argument to be made that her level never returned, because maybe that's what she was, you know, I'm just saying maybe that's where she got her level. It's a touchy subject. It's hard to talk about, but you know, maybe if Halep just comes out swinging and obviously isn't doping now, then it's pretty easy to believe that she wasn't in the past. But I don't know.
Tell you what, the Serena Williams fans are loving you right now.
I'm just playing devil's advocate.
Wow. It's getting late for us here in the UK. We have lawyers. Why didn't you tell me this? I've got so many libelous accusations that I could spite and smoke out on this show. Where do I start? But yeah, thanks for coming on, Jack. Really, really appreciate you doing that.
No worries.
Always great to hear your views and analysis. And I enjoy just being able to sit back and learn something new.
I appreciate that, Nick. Yeah, thanks very much for having me on. Pleasure to talk to you as always.
All right. Well, regardless of whether the next year or so is of WTA Weekly is full of libelous accusations or not, I do want to say it's been absolutely brilliant doing this for most of the last year or so. I do want to make sure that we do mention that obviously the show was briefly hosted by our friend Jakub Bobrow, who obviously we miss very much, and he did a great job when he held the reins. For those who want to know, on the ATP side, Pedro Martinez is the Jakub Bobrow Player of the Week, and we'll keep on doing that in his honour. But I know he's a big fan of the WTA, as we all are on this show. I think one of the things I most enjoy about doing this is being one of the leading lights in promoting this incredible product, this incredible standard of sport that the WTA produces, and all the great stories that come from it, because I honestly feel like it's not talked about enough. Thanks, everyone, for being along for Ride for the Day, for today, for the last 12 months. And I look forward to seeing you many, many more times on WTA Weekly, because we will be back next week to wrap up all things Billie Jean King Cup and look forward to Stuttgart and Rouen, but mainly Stuttgart, because we'll be there. So until then, as always, take care and keep talking tennis.
I want one more thing from you, Francisca. Can you look at the camera? And I want you to say, I am Francisca Jorge, and I am a friend of the show. Can you try it?
I am Francisca Jorge, and I'm a friend. Wait.
Go. It's okay.
I'm Francisca Jorge, and I'm a fan of the show.
One more time. Can you say, I'm a friend of the show?
Friend.
Like amigo. Friend.
Friend.
So, because we joke, we have players come on all the time. They have no idea, but after they've been on, we say, oh, Yelena Ostapenko is a friend of the show. She has no idea. But so if we get you to say, I am Francisca Jorge, or how you say your name, and I'm a friend of the show.
I am Francisca Jorge, and I'm a friend of the show.
Perfect. Thanks.
Sports Social Podcast Network.